Session number 12989, Thomas Finnegan, Reel 1.
Can we start with your telling me where you were born, please?
I was born in Portsmouth at a military hospital at Hilsey Barracks.
Do you come from an Irish family?
No, no.
Where does the name come from?
The name, previously, yes, many generations ago, it was an Irish family. But as far as I know, that my father was in the services, and so was his father, and the father before him, so it goes back several generations.
Did you go to school in Portsmouth?
I went to, I started school in Egypt. my father, as I said, was in the army. At 4 years of age, we travelled to Egypt for a period of 5 years, and I started school there at the age of four.
Which unit was he in?
He was in the Royal Army Ordnance Corps.
When did you come back to Britain?
We came back to Britain in 1934.
And when and why did you come to join the army yourself?
Originally, I intended to join the Navy, which is rather peculiar, being that all my ancestors and my father were army personnel. But being that Portsmouth was a naval town, I really wanted to go into the Navy, but I was far too young. And my father came back one particular day and said that he had been down to the Naval Recruiting Office to find out what the entrance examination was, and I would have to wait until I was 15 years of age. Then I was only 12 and a half, but the entrance examination would be for the army at 13 years of age.
Was it easy for you to get into the army in the event?
In the event of going into the army, I was rather keen on joining the services, and at that time, my friends, you know, who I was at school with, they were all determined to go into the services as well.
So you went in as a boy at 14?
At 14 years of age, just 14.
When was that?
That was in July, the 5th of July 1939.
What did you first do on joining the army?
The intention was to learn a trade. It was the idea of the War Office at the time to modernise the army, and they built these special camps for the Royal Engineers, the Royal Army Ordnance Corps and the Royal Army Service Corps. The Royal Engineers was at Chatham at a place called Fort Darland, which later became the School of Military Engineering. But the Royal Army Ordnance Corps Boys School was built at Arborfield, and the Royal Army Service Corps Boys School was built at Jersey in the Channel Islands.
So you were at Chatham?
I was at Chatham.
What did you do there at first?
At first, we did our preliminary training and then started our carried on with our education, of course, and we started our trade training.
What did it consist of?
And my trade was carpenter and joiner.
Can you describe what you were doing?
Well, we started off as in the workshops, as you would do for a normal tradesman. We didn't make tea as such, like you would do in civilian life for the first year or so. We went straight into woodcraft and as practical as well as the other side.
How long did all this take?
Well, it should have taken 4 years. But as you know, the war started in September of 39, and that completely disrupted things.
So did your trade training then stop?
No, the trade training still carried on until... but before, what actually disrupted things was that when the war started, we were all sent down to the workshops and we were manufacturing thousands upon thousands of duckboards, because at that time they thought it was going to be another trench warfare. But that carried on until the Dunkirk situation, and then we stopped the manufacturer of these duckboards.
How do you make a duckboard?
It was the duckboards were made in a jig. We manufactured jigs, and then it was a matter of placing the two runners and then the cross pieces and hammering all together. And there was quite a lot of lorries coming every day to pick these things up and take them down to the railway station. And then they were shipped off to France.
How did this affect the morale of the boys doing all
well,
this?
Well, the morale of the boys was very, very high because at that age we were rather impetuous. It was a new thing to us. And the morale was very, very high, you know, intensely high.
But didn't they get fed up of doing the same thing?
No, because we thought we were doing it for the war effort, and that was it. But because when they all came back from Dunkirk, because it was an entirely different situation then.
Did you see anything of that, the returning troops?
Well, we saw it, yes. There was quite a few of the returning troops. And as a matter of fact, eventually, just after that, we got... We got sent to Chepstow, which was another boys' school which started off in the early 20s. And that, the boys there were general service boys. They did not know, or they were taught a trade, but they didn't know which corps that they were going in until they attained the age of 18. But of course, we, going to our, like Chatham for the Royal Engineers, we had the Royal Engineer cap badge. We were very, very young sappers, although we weren't called sappers at the time. We were called apprentice tradesmen.
So what was the next job that you had?
What, from boy service?
Yes.
We left. What happened was that they, when the war started, boys were discontinued being called up after their examinations. And they decided that there was quite a lot of boys in Chepstow at the time, because all the boys' schools congregated at Chepstow, and there was quite a number of us, and they decided that we would leave boys' service before we should have done. Instead of leaving at 18, we were leaving at 17, going into man service.
So this would be in 42?
This is in 1942, 43, yes.
But what were you doing between 40 and 42?
In boy service, we were trade training.
Did you do any infantry-style training?
No, we did, yes and no. We did a little training as regards blowing up railway lines and with sticky bombs and Hawkins grenades and little things like that.
Which grenades?
A Hawkins grenade.
What's that?
It's a grenade that, how can I describe it? It was like a talcum powder tin, and it on the top it had a raised piece with a V, and that used to, a tank used to roll over this, and it used to blow the track off.
You were telling me earlier off the record that the boys were too small to handle.
That's right. Yes. When the war started, we were given some of these. I think they were P-14 rifles, which was American issue from the First World War, which were rather heavy, and we just couldn't lift them. So they discontinued that. They withdrew those and issued us with pick halves. And we used to go out on guard of the camp and the local railway tunnels, and this was from Dunkirk time, just after Dunkirk.
How much use do you think you would have been if there had been an invasion?
Not very much. Not very much. At 15 years of age, we were rather green and looking up into the sky waiting for the stormtroopers to appear. You know, it wasn't very
Did you yourself think there was going to be an invasion?
At that time, yes. At that time, yes. But there was no way that we could have stopped anybody.
Did you think that Britain was liable to be defeated at that time?
No. No. That never. I don't think that ever entered any of our heads at all.
Even though you were down to pick halves?
We were down to pick halves, yes. That's right. But there was no way, I don't think that there was any way that they would have put us into action, not at that age.
What did you think of the quality of trade training that you got in the Royal Engineers?
Excellent. It was far, far superior to what you would have got outside in civilian life. Far superior. The instructors were absolutely first class. There was no doubt. They were handpicked. They were handpicked for that particular job.
So you said that in 1942 you became, as it were, a man soldier.
Man soldier, yes.
What happened to you then?
Well, we went into various training regiments. I went back to Chatham, as a matter of fact, to Kitchener Barracks, and we did our sapper training. That is the bridge building, the demolitions, mine lifting, and all that sort of thing. The sort of thing that we were going to do at a later date. That was the sapper training.
Did you have any problems with that kind of work?
No. We were, is it on?
Yes.
I must say that we classed ourselves as a little bit more intelligent than the average soldier that was coming in. We had still carried on with our education, and we had all got the qualifications that were required for warrant officers at that time.
When did you finally finish all this training?
It was a 3 months training after leaving boy service. That was completed the proper sapper training as such. After that, we did a 3 months higher trade training course in another barracks, also in Chatham. We marched from one barracks to the other, and we did a 3 months higher trade training. That was after our initial training for becoming a proper sapper.
When did you finally join an operational unit?
Directly after that. We did. I did. At that time, they were forming up the new branch of the army, the airborne forces, and the majority of us applied to go into the airborne forces. But I was one of those that was too young to go in. They only accepted half of them because they were of age. At 18, but all the 17 and a halves, we couldn't go in for that sort of thing. We were far too young. So we joined a proper field company of the Royal Engineers.
What was the attraction of parachuting to you, or airborne to you?
It was a new thing, and we felt that you must realise that a boy soldier is trained from the very, very beginning to become a soldier. And that was the thing that we wanted to go into, was the paratroops.
And what was the field unit that...
The field unit I joined was a field unit that was formed in 1940 for chemical warfare. They were using rockets for gas and other sort of things that was at that time. There was quite a lot of field companies that were doing this sort of work. When General Montgomery took over, when he came back from the Middle East, he took over the army that was going to go into Northwest Europe at that time, because we didn't know whether we were going to Normandy or not. And he wanted a very young army, and he got rid of everyone over the age of 34 years of age, and brought in a number of youngsters, not all the same age as myself. The others were 18 and 19 years of age when they were being called up. We were called up at 18. And we filled the blank spaces of all these particular units. And at that time, they were starting to do the training for wet landings on LCIs.
When did you join this chemical warfare unit?
I didn't join the chemical warfare unit. It started in 1940 and it finished in early 1943. And I joined just after they had finished the chemical warfare and become a field company instead of a chemical warfare company.
What was the name of the company?
The 85th Field Company.
Where did you join it?
I joined it in Scotland at a place called Stewarton. There were six of us from the boys' school that joined the company all at the same time.
Was this in 43?
This is in 43, yes. And the company at that time were doing training at Dundonald in Inverary on wet landings from landing craft. They used to scramble down the side of a ship into the landing craft and then come ashore and do their various projects that they had to do, clearing beaches and doing all this and that.
So that's what you went on to when you joined them?
When I joined the company, that's what we were doing, yes. And then in early 44, we all moved down into the south of England and carried out various exercises. At that time, they were getting more information back from the RAF photographers, and they started to increase the equipment that we had to carry. So eventually we couldn't scramble down the nets of the ships. So we started going aboard LCI Large, which was landing craft infantry large. They had two ramps in the bows that came down. Eventually we ended up by carrying so much equipment that we had to be helped to put it on. The equipment that we normally wear on our backs had to come on our fronts, and on our backs we had to carry what they call G1098. That's all your pick, shovels and crowbars and felling axes and so on, plus explosives and all your mine detectors and what have you.
And what was the extra equipment carried?
The extra equipment was explosives and your G1098. Your G1098, of course, is the schedule that a unit normally holds.
Were there some of the sappers who just didn't have the strength to cope with it?
We were trained in it. What happened was that when we went on board ship, we had to unload our equipment on deck and leave it on deck. And then we used to go down into inside and sleep on the stand, what they call the standees. It was like a bed. And then when we were ready to come ashore, we used to go up on deck and put our equipment on then. The only things that we used to take downstairs was our arms.
Did you say the standees was a bed?
It's like a bed, yes. It's
or a bench?
A bed. They were in three tiers, made of canvas. At the very beginning, they were benches. At the very beginning, they were wooden benches. But you spend about 4 or 5 days on sitting on a wooden bench, and then you had to go ashore. You weren't very well. You know, you couldn't do the things that they wanted you to do. You couldn't sleep. You had to sit up all the time. You know, sort of thing.
So they were made out of canvas.
They were made out of canvas on a frame. Like a camp bed, but in three tiers.
So did any of the sappers get any problems with strained muscles or back strain or anything like that because of the weight?
Well, the object was that all we had to do was to carry it on board ship and take it off ship. There was no way that we could carry it for several miles. So you're talking about 140 to 160 pounds in weight altogether. I, for instance, had to carry a Bren gun with, at that time, a Bren gunner had a number two that carried your spare parts. That's a spare barrel and the spare part, and also the ammunition tin, which carried 12 more extra magazines. But when we were doing the wet landings, we had to cut out the number two, and the number one, which was the Bren gunner himself, he had to carry the spare parts and the spare ammunition as well.
Were there any accidents during the training, serious accidents?
Yes, there was quite a... especially when we were at Studland, Studland Bay. That was a live ammunition being used. with the rocket ships and all the rest of it. I remember a particular occasion where we were carrying Bangalore torpedoes ashore. Now, a Bangalore torpedo is a 2-inch pipe, roughly about 10 to 12 foot long, full of explosive, and that was pushed through a barbed wire entanglement, and then you set it off and it used to blow the wire apart. And one particular occasion where we had an infantry battalion who used to look after us. Once the sappers are in minefields and you're under fire, then you have to have someone to protect you. You don't take your arms into a minefield. And we had this infantry battalion, which was the a battalion of the King's Liverpool Irish. And we were on the beach for about 10 days when one of these Bangalore torpedoes went up, and it killed several men.
Did you see the accident?
Yes, I did see the accident. We were getting up in the morning and having our wash when it went off, and it was a matter of about 100 yards down, and it was rather gruesome.
Was there somebody at fault?
Yes, there was somebody at fault. What really happened, what came out in the inquiry, was that they were using it over a fire and boiling their water. I think there was about 17 that died that particular day.
Boiling their water?
Their water in cans. We had cans, to boil water for washing facilities and that sort of thing. Because we'd been on the beach there for about 12 days. We were there for 3 weeks, in actual fact. We were testing out the new rations that we were going to take.
But they had the Bangalore torpedo near the fire?
Yes, they were using it as a support over the fire. This is what came out in the Board of Inquiry after the exercise.
Any accidents to your unit?
Yes, we did lose two sappers. What we used to do was one platoon would lay a minefield, and then another platoon would come up and clear that minefield. And this particular time, it was live. Everything was live. And two died. We laid a minefield, and the chaps who were clearing it, coming up behind us, it went off. And two died.
How confident did you feel about D-Day as it approached?
We felt very confident. When we moved down, at the very end of our training, and it was getting near the time that we were going to move, we were all taken to our various camps that we had to go into. The unit that I was in, we went to a place called Chandler's Ford, which is between Winchester and Southampton. And we were living in the woods there in tents. And every man knew his serial number. The serial number that I was in was 1121. I'll never forget that. And that was the number of the LCI. Now, what happened was that when we did various other training before D-Day, it used to come over the tannoy that serial number so-and-so would pick up their kit and fall in on the road. Trucks would come round and pick you up and go round in a circle. And by that time, all the remainder of the serial numbers were also doing the same thing. And you would end up maybe at the same tent as you started off with, but you wouldn't have your unit would have been split up, and we were supporting the Canadians, the Canadian division, and you might end up with a couple of Canadians in your tent with maybe a couple of chaps who were say, in the Royal Air Force, who were carrying a balloon ashore. We had these small balloons that were on the bows of every ship that went in. And the winch, they used to lift the winch up, and the balloon used to hold the winch, so they just carried it ashore, and they were all along the beach then. And there was one, so there was one for our particular serial number, which is two RAF lads used to carry this balloon ashore, like a barrage balloon. And there was no artillery, of course. We didn't need any artillery, but it was mostly Canadian infantry, British sappers, medical people. And we were purely the beach support troops. We had to get them ashore and made sure that there was no more obstacles. We had to clear all the obstacles so that they could come ashore at a later, you know, after the 8 hour sort of thing. But when we arrived at this transit camp in Chandler's Ford, the name of the camp was a serial number C1, and they had these big sand tables there in a large marquee that we used to go and have lectures on. And that showed you the actual beach that you was going to land on. The beach was split into three. It was red, green and amber. But of course all the names were fictitious. We didn't know whether it was going to be Northern France, Normandy or Holland or Belgium or Norway. We didn't know that. So the sand table, all the little villages and the towns were all fictitious names. Possibly London, Moscow, and that sort of thing. But you knew exactly what beach you were going to land on, and you could see all the obstacles that were there, which was very, very accurate indeed, very accurate. And we used to go in there on our own and study these maps. And you knew exactly, so when you were coming ashore, you could say, right, that's where I'm going to be. If the ship lands 100 yards down or up sort of thing, you know which way to go. That's where I've got to be. That's where my job starts. Everyone had their own job that they were going to do.